And now, welcome to Oasis Forum, where we explore issues that can help us positively evolve our lives, our society, and our planet. Oasis Forum features authors, activists, artists, and healers working to increase our appreciation of the interconnectedness of life on Earth. Each week, we explore a new topic that impacts our health, our families, our communities, our work, and our environment. Our goal is not just to discuss present challenges, but to develop an awareness of root causes and, importantly, to explore potential solutions. At Oasis Forum, our aim is to inspire hope and share practical ideas for creating a world that works for all. And good evening. This is John Michael Dumay, and we are on Oasis Forum, and we're very happy to have with us tonight from Portland, Oregon, Tom Attlee, who is the author of The Tao of Democracy. Yeah, and I am getting some static on the line. I hope we can take care of that at some point, but we'll just continue on. Is that coming in from my side? We'll continue on. Tom is the author, again, of The Tao of Democracy, Using Co-Intelligence to Create a World That Works for All. Born in an activist family 58 years ago, Tom Attlee has worked consistently for peace, democracy, environmental sanity, and cultural evolution. The founder and co-director of the Co-Intelligence Institute in Eugene, Oregon, he now writes on collaboration and holistic social change. His many articles on holistic politics, philosophy, and social transformation can be found in the Permaculture Activist, Science of Mind, Turning Wheel, Yes Magazine, Noetics Review, Earthlight, and other alternative journals. On his website, cointelligence.org, and we'll give that URL before the end of the program again, and on his new blog, newmediaexplorer.org/Tom_Attlee. If that's not the newest one, Tom, we'll have a chance to give you correct that. In recent years, he has articulated a new vision of democracy based on citizens' capacity to generate collective wisdom, fully described in his book that I mentioned earlier, The Tao of Democracy, and available locally or online. He has collected over 100 democratic innovations on his democracy website. In the last two decades, Tom has steadily evolved from issue-based politics to social process activism, which we'll definitely get into a deeper discussion of. His work is rooted in a belief that wholeness is the ultimate guide to where we're going. He has written extensively about the various dimensions and dynamics of wholeness, both from a theoretical and very practical perspective. His concept of co-intelligence embraces all the ways intelligence would be different if it arose from the realities of wholeness, interconnectedness, and co-creativity. And so without further ado, Tom Attlee, welcome to Oasis Forum.
Thank you very much, John Michael. Good to be here.
All right. It's good to have you. And you're calling in from Portland, Oregon, and we appreciate you coming in on this wonderful, cool but nice afternoon here in Keene, New Hampshire area. And before we get into, a discussion of some of the particulars, can you just give our listeners a sense of what co-intelligence is and maybe just a brief overview of your book?
Sure. Well, the simplest answer to the question what is co-intelligence is it's the opposite of co-stupidity. Most people, when I say that, have a chuckle because they've seen co-stupidity and they instantly recognize what it is. And I think that's absolutely fascinating that people have never heard either word before and they recognize co-stupidity and don't quite know what co-intelligence is. It says a lot about our culture.
Mm-hmm.
The main dimension of co-intelligence that I work with is collective intelligence. I created the term co-intelligence, but this term collective intelligence has been used for several decades by many other people in organizational development and, computers, people who envision the global brain, et cetera, have spoken global brain. It's like the web and all the communications that go on there and all the information that's stored there, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
My major interest, because I'm concerned with the direction that our civilization is heading, is in creating a collective capacity to gather information and reflect on that information, reflect our experience at a collective level, not just an individual level, so that we can more coherently and wisely respond to the kinds of crises that we are currently creating for ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Uh, and And it seems to me with the level of crises that we have cropping up, they're unprecedented in their variety and scope and the kinds of realms that they're occurring in. I mean, like biotechnology and stuff. I mean, the things that are coming down the pike are so unusual that if we make it through the 21st century, it seems to me we will have to have achieved some level of collective wisdom as a culture, because if we don't, we're going to, you know, sort of take ourselves apart mm-hmm. as a civilization.
Mm-hmm.
That's my own motivation. I know that's a debatable point,
mm-hmm.
but that's where my focus on generating the capacity for collective intelligence and wisdom in our political and governmental processes. I talk about creating a wise democracy. Our current democracy is grounded in debate and battle, the effort by different sides to get a majority of the public to support their views, and usually in very manipulative and not terribly enlightening ways.
That's right.
The system is not designed to help people see the full complexity of the problem, the reasons why different people have different perspectives on it, and to be able to talk, have different people talk with each other, different people who are actually informed about the scene, talk with each other without an agenda except the discovery of something that would make sense for all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out when you actually do that, like with randomly selected people, educating them about an issue and letting them talk together in search of something that makes sense for all of them and for their community,
mm-hmm.
it's remarkable the extent, they can't always, but the extent to which they come up with something that actually does make sense, that is quite appealing to the people who come and look at it. And that capacity of groups of people, of diverse people, to come to some coherent understanding, I'm really interested in figuring out how to plug that into the political system so that there is at least as much of that going on as there is the political battle.
Indeed.
And the book describes quite a variety of ways to go about doing that.
Well, I must say, when I read your book, my spine was tingling, and I say that in no small way because I really recognize the co-intelligence and the holistic technologies that you talk about as the way of the future. It was terribly exciting. And even though you describe, you know, what I perceive to be as a true illustration of the gridlock in Washington and in our political process, you also describe in your book so many examples from small groups to almost entire nations. If we're looking at the citizen deliberative councils, for example, in Canada that have taken place that really show some hope for all of us moving forward. I was just going to say despite our diversity, but I really want to say in the spirit of your book, because of our diversity, being able to move forward.
Right. Well, look, the actual, it's sort of too bad because the most remarkable thing like this that's ever happened after I published the book. The Citizens Assembly in British Columbia, I think it was the Liberal Party there, before they were elected several years ago, there was lots of conflict over how they were doing elections, sort of like in our last two elections, there are lots of people questioning, you know, the Electoral College and voting machines and all this sort of stuff, and some people even questioning majoritarianism and the winner-take-all kind of approaches.
Yes.
And so they said, if you elect us, we will pick a randomly selected group of citizens to be a citizens' assembly, and we'll make sure that they get educated in all different ways there could be to do an election, and they will study that and decide if we should change our system.
Mm-hmm.
And if they do recommend a change, we will put it on the ballot, and if the people agree to it, then that's the way we'll do elections.
Mm-hmm.
And that they did that last year. There were 160 people. There were randomly selected a man and a woman selected at random from each one of their legislative districts.
Mm-hmm. So
it was equal men and women from all over the country, and they made sure to have indigenous people on it, et cetera.
That's right.
And so there's a widely diverse group of people, and 160 is a sizable group to work with,
mm-hmm.
but they had tremendous support from the government because this was an official program of the government.
Right.
And they heard there was like 2 months during which every other weekend they would spend the weekend listening to experts talk in various forms of options for doing elections from different parts of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'd talk about them, and they'd cross-examine the experts and ask them questions. And they'd study all sorts of materials they were given. They asked for input from the country. Anybody who had some, white paper or other on one approach or argumentation on one approach or another was welcome to send stuff in, and I think there were like 1,500 reports that were sent to them.
Mm-hmm.
And then they went around and did hearings all over British Columbia. Several members of the Citizen Assembly would go, and people would be able to stand up and speak and say, tell the people in the Assembly how they felt about this, that, or the other option,
mm-hmm.
or just how they felt about the way the electoral system was running in British Columbia.
Right.
They did all this, and then they took a couple of months to deliberate about it and go back and forth. What are the different trade-offs, the advantages and disadvantages of all these methods, and what would seem to fit where we are? And they ended up taking thing called single transferable vote, a method that's used in like two places in the world,
mm-hmm.
and adapting it to British Columbia. So they have a thing which is totally unique to British Columbia. For people who know, who are familiar with the voting debates, it's like a special mix of proportional representation and instant runoff voting,
right.
Which are two of the options that are most frequently advocated by voter reform people.
Mm-hmm.
And they came up with this last year, and there's a website that it's like citizenassembly.bc.ca, BC, British Columbia, CA, Canada.
Yep, I checked that out
public.
Last night, yep.
Yeah, and I hope they leave the website up. They're saying they might take it down after the election.
Yeah, they said they would take it down on the 17th, and I saw a lot of great files. They're great research. I mean, just amazing what they did.
I'm hoping there's this thing called the Internet Archive. I'm hoping they have this archive because it's unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that they have done something that is the most empowered and powerful form of citizen deliberation
mm-hmm.
in the modern world. I mean, it's to a certain extent, the Greeks used to do that. They have lots of highly participatory, highly high-quality sort of national conversations given their small Athenian nation-state. But they excluded a lot of people, and this is could be argued to be the most high quality empowered citizen deliberation in history. And they're going to take down the website. It's mind boggling. But May 17th is when they're having their election,
mm-hmm.
And if it passes, it will be they'll make it into legislation that becomes the law of the land.
That's astounding.
And it's just like, and it costs a lot to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And they did. I think it was like 1/20 of 1% of the entire budget for British Columbia was spent on that exercise.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not as if you could do something that fancy with every issue, but there's week-long kinds of things like citizen juries and
mm-hmm.
consensus conferences. These are different names for similar processes where you pick a randomly selected group of people,
mm-hmm.
usually just like a dozen or two dozen people. But they're randomly selected to be a cross-section of the population, sort of like juries are.
Right.
Citizen juries mm-hmm. are directly modeled on juries. But it's not doing a court, it's not like a court jury. It is a jury of public affairs, what on some issue, how should it be dealt with? And again, they have a chance to speak directly to experts.
Mm-hmm.
And to cross-examine opposing experts. And there's tremendous effort goes into making sure that the materials they're given cannot be accused of bias, that they
mm-hmm.
that they represent a spectrum of opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And then they deliberate and they come up with their statements in the other, very empowered form is in Denmark, the mm-hmm. consensus conferences, where the randomly selected people are, they're only convened when Parliament is struggling with a highly complex and controversial
mm-hmm.
technical issue.
Mm-hmm.
They're not just any old issue. It's these high-tech issues that
right.
they're struggling with.
Right.
And they convene these 15 Danes that's selected at random, and they get educated. And then they have a lot more power than in citizen juries to
mm-hmm.
actually decide which experts they're going to talk to.
Really?
They do over a period of a couple of months. They have two weekends where they meet, talk, they study materials, they talk to each other, and they talk to the organizers from Parliament
right.
regarding who they can see as an expert. And then when they interview the experts, it's in a public forum. So it's not off in a room somewhere like a citizen jury. This is out in a big hall where there's the media and the general public and the partisans and,
right.
and stakeholders are all there in the audience.
Yep.
And they're in the position of power like the Senate hearings are. You know, the senators up there in their seats and the experts have to come and testify to the senators. Well, these aren't senators. These are ordinary citizens who
right.
are picked by lot. And their recommendations, when they find, they have to come up with a consensus. It's like juries in the sense that they have to all agree on certain things, and what they agree on is then passed on to Parliament as an official document, and there's a big press conference at the end,
right?
Where the public learns about this, and sometimes they even organize discussion groups around the country to help generate the political environment to deal with this issue better.
I just get tingles again. I can imagine that being applied to all kinds of, you know, conflicting, controversial issues, you know, genetically modified organisms, you know, nuclear power, you know, which isn't to say one side is right or one side is wrong, but what was fascinating for me to hear and to read is how your average citizen becomes, empowered to, I guess it kind of felt like the democratization of authority in some kind of way. They weren't just relying on the experts to come in and say, but a normal citizen. Can you tell me what is it about this process that makes a normal citizen or this kind of deliberative council work versus just experts talking to our elected officials? What's different about your average person or a group of average people that isn't there when just the experts and the top elected people talk to each other?
There's a variety of things. One of the most significant ones was identified by Frances Moore LePay, who's the author of Diet for a Small Planet is her most famous thing. She's had a number of recent books also.
Yep.
But she said that experts should be on tap, not on top.
Mm-hmm.
And she points out that the experts know a lot about the issue, about, you know, what are the trade-offs, what are the consequences, how do the dynamics of this thing, you know, unfold, what's going on here in a sort of technical sense. But when you make a decision, I mean, it's like, you're deciding which college you're going to go to, or, you know, whether you're going to marry somebody or something like that. You can gather lots of information, but at the end, it doesn't matter how much information you have. You have to make a value judgment at the end.
Mm-hmm.
You have to decide what's important to you, and which way you're going to go. It's like you can give a computer all this information, but it can't make a decision because it needs to know what is it that's valuable. On what basis would you make a decision one way or another?
Mm-hmm.
And it's been pointed out that in a democracy, and for those of us who are Democrats at heart anywhere, it should be the values of the community that ground where, you know, that navigate which way the culture is going to go.
Mm-hmm.
So the citizens are experts in the values of the community. They can see how something is going to play out in their community or in their country. They can sense what is it going to mean for their own lives, and they can bring their values to bear on it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the experts are not legitimate arbiters of the values of the community.
Mm-hmm.
To a certain degree, we have passed over that decision to the elected representatives. Theoretically, we've chosen them because they reflect our values, and they will apply them in these circumstances, which is to a certain extent true, but to an increasing extent, it feels like that's not what's going on in most of these legislatures. That the money in politics is a gigantic thing in many places. I know there's some, I don't know if New Hampshire's one of them, but I know Maine and Arizona, several states have removed money largely from politics, which is another major, major problem.
Yeah.
A lot of these legislators complain that they spend most of their time trying to fundraise, and then somebody gives them a lot of money, they end up being beholden to them, and then the whole system that they're embedded in is not a, here's a problem, how should we deal with it? It's, not framed that way. It's like, here's a proposal, are you for or against it?
Right, exactly.
That's a very much lower form of intelligence when you start with a proposal rather than going, here's the situation, let's look at the dynamics of the situation, let's try to understand the nature of this problem, what are the different options that are possible, what are the trade-offs, goods and bads, with each of these options, you know, to really, that's what's called deliberation. to really consider it thoroughly and weigh the different pieces. And what happens so often in Congress, say, is, you know, the deal making that says, if you vote for me, I'll vote for your bill kind of thing,
right,
rather than taking the issue on its merits. To say nothing of the political, political manipulations that go on.
Right.
We're a party and we're going to all vote together, and if you don't, you're going to be in big trouble.
Right.
Is a whole, that should have nothing whatsoever to do with, with actually making decisions.
Well, that's the win-lose system with the ultimately the threat of violence keeping it in place.
Yes. It feels to me that in this sense, peace and democracy are like really related to each other because I grew up as a peace activist, and a good chunk of my life I spent as a peace activist, and that meant overwhelmingly fighting against war, fighting against weapon systems, fighting against nuclear stuff, and it was it was more an anti-movement than a positive movement.
Yes,
and
yes.
It seems like the positive side of peace is that people are working, diverse people are working together to co-create whatever their future is supposed to be together. And that's what you, when you do mediation or negotiation, that's basically what you're trying to do. You're bringing the parties together that are in conflict, and you're saying, okay, guys, you're all in the same boat, you know, how do you want to work this out? You can all live with it. And that's like that's when you're already in intense conflict. Before you get into the intense conflict, it would be nice to have a society in which what's going on is people who are different are talking together about what they'd like to have in the future and what they're going to do about that. And that's what democracy should be, too. So for me, the peace and democracy issues, and even sustainability, I mean, it's like, if you're not listening to certain voices, they're going to talk louder, and they're going to start flying their planes into your twin towers, and it's like the excluded voices will not stay quiet.
Yes.
You know, that's happened, that's proven over and over and over again. That's a factor in unsustainability. And one of the things that happens when you have diverse people in a conversation, if the conversation is designed well, is that they raise questions about each other's assumptions. They have diverse information bases, so they can each bring different information that if you're on a partisan position, you don't tend to, I don't read conservative magazines. You know, I come out of a progressive kind of, you know, past and environment.
Yes.
And I read conservative magazines. I get all upset about what they're saying, and I basically write off a good deal of what they talk about.
Right.
And I know that the conservatives, if they ever bother to read a liberal magazine, are doing exactly the same thing.
Exactly.
You know, then the situation is set up in such a way that we don't tend to talk to each other. But if you can have a conversation that's being facilitated, you know, convened and facilitated by parties who are not bought into one result or another, in that context, people who are very different can share their differences in ways that add to each other rather than undermine each other.
Right.
And the potentials of that are really incredible.
Yeah, I wonder if you could say more about that. And I read with absolute fascination the story of the Canadians that was written up in Maclean's magazine.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you could say more about what the process is that gets people beyond, you know, the head level, the intellectual level of, this is my position, and I believe it's the best position. What is the essential piece that helps move them beyond their positionalities? What does that process look like, and how do you see that, you know, being engaged on that kind of scale in a place like the United States?
Well, there's several. Yeah, first of all, I have to say that a lot of these things that, you know, you say Canada is more united than we are. Well, sort of, maybe yes, maybe no. People have said that the Danish model only works in Denmark because, you know, the Danes are a much more homogenous culture than we are.
Well, there is that.
But the same process that they use in Denmark, that the problem used in Denmark, has been experimented with a number of times in the United States with similar results. So that's already been basically disproven. I'm living in the inquiry of what are the basics that are at work in all of these processes, and what are the most powerful and, you know, those basics that I can identify. And I won't say this as a fact, but my current state of understanding or belief is that probably the most powerful dimension is people feeling hurt. And it is so unusual in our culture for people to feel heard. And there's a fine and important distinction between them being heard and them feeling heard.
Yes, yes.
And there's a couple of processes that specialize in this.
Mm-hmm.
There's one called dynamic facilitation that I write a lot about in the book and talk about a lot of times, a lot of places on my site.
Right.
It's the most powerful facilitation process I've ever run across, and probably 80% of the expertise that's involved by the facilitator is in having everybody involved feel really heard.
Yes. And this is Jim. This is Jim Ruff's work, is that correct?
Yes.
And there was information in your book about the four charts that he uses. I'm wondering if you would just briefly outline what those are.
The four charts are part of the sort of infrastructure, but they're not the heart.
Mm-hmm.
His traditional work. He's an organizational consultant. A lot of these processes come from organizational consultants.
Mm-hmm.
He's an organizational consultant who comes out of the creative problem solving kind of consulting.
Mm-hmm.
Works with businesses to help them creatively solve their problems.
Yes.
And so his charts are problem statements and possible solutions and concerns and data.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the four chart pads that he has up in front of the room when he facilitates.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, you get people together who are sharing a problem, particularly like a working group in a business is the archetypal example.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all upset with each other, and they're upset with the bosses or the people in the other divisions or whatever it is. It's not working for them, whatever's going on, and they all are embedded in the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Whether on the same side or whether on opposite sides, it's less important than they are all passionately embedded in the problem and really upset about it.
Mm-hmm.
He says it's dynamic facilitation is great for impossible people and impossible problems.
Yeah.
And so the facilitator, comes in, he has his chart pad there, and goes, so what do you guys want to talk about? And somebody will raise their hand, and they will start saying whatever's on their mind, usually some naming of the situation that's real to them.
Mm-hmm.
And they describe the situation, the facilitator will go, so what would you... And meanwhile, the facilitator is writing this stuff down on the chart pad, on the problem statements. And he says, well, let me see if I got this right. You're saying blah, 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 whatever it was he said that he wrote down. And if the facilitator gets it right, the guy nods or whatever. And he says, so what would you do about that?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think ought to be done? And so the guy will go on saying whatever he's saying, and he'll go over to the facilitator, goes over to the chart pad that has possible solutions and is writing down the things that this guy's saying. And somebody else is getting really upset about all this, and they raise their hand, and they say, that guy's, crazy, that's not the problem at all.
Mm-hmm.
So they said, oh, so what's your concern?
Mm-hmm.
What would you say that's going on here? What's making you so upset here?
Right.
And any embattled energy, any invalidating energy, the facilitator translates into a concern.
Yes.
So what's the concern? And I've had this applied to me when I was taking Jim's class, the first time I ever took Jim Russ's class. I've taken it about three times.
Mm-hmm.
I had it applied to me in a way. I was really upset with somebody else in this practice facilitation thing that they were saying about how we should do our healthcare system.
Mm-hmm.
And I was about to blurt out to them when the facilitator came, right up next to me, goes, come on, give it to me. What's your concern? And I was very aware. It's like an Aikido move. It's like something just happened in my awareness.
Mm-hmm.
She's now, all of my negative energy was being dispelled,
mm-hmm.
and she was taking what gift I had to give. And, I said, okay, well, I don't think it should be this way, blah, blah. And she's writing it down, saying, mm-hmm. do I have it right? And I
mm-hmm.
say, that's pretty good except for this. It's okay. Do I have it right now? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think ought to be done? It's like suddenly I'm back into the problem-solving flow.
That's right.
This is smooth, smooth, very interesting. When it's done well, it's unbelievable. But the thing that's at the bottom of it all, she is going around the room, whoever's the facilitator,
mm.
is going around the room making sure that each person who has stuff to say has a chance to say it so that it's out there in the group space and that they feel heard so that they don't have to keep pushing it.
That's right.
They can open up and hear other people. And so it's a very nonlinear process. There's not a, here, let's define the problem first, and then we're going to look at a brainstorm solutions. It's nothing like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, as it pops up, you take whatever's there
mm-hmm.
and make make sure it's heard, make sure it's recorded in the group space.
Mm-hmm.
And as this nonlinear process unfolds, it sort of moves into a space where people have basically felt heard, and they've heard each other.
Yes.
Because the facilitator, as the designated listener, like the designated driver, you know, who's trained to listen and does it well,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so everybody's sitting there, and what's in front of them in the group space is the full complexity of the problem that they never bothered to really attend to,
mm-hmm.
because they were writing each other off.
Mm-hmm.
Now they see, oh gosh, this is a mess. This is big,
mm-hmm.
and they're all open.
Yeah.
So what happens is suddenly they start to be in a space where they can get creative together,
mm-hmm.
and that tendency that humans have when there's something weird going on. They try and make sense of it. There's a problem, they try and solve it. There's something that doesn't make sense, they try and figure out what's some way I can look at this that actually makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
All that effort, that urge by the human mind to create sense and to solve things, they are now doing collectively to deal with the full scope of the problem in front of them. And so you
mm-hmm.
start getting wildly creative ideas. And suddenly the group, and this has happened a number of times, I've been part of groups, where it's like suddenly you're on a fast-moving train, and the ideas are flying fast and furious, and the energy is getting higher and higher, and it's like, whoa,
mm-hmm.
what? Where did this come from?
Mm-hmm.
And it's the rock bottom thing is people feeling fully heard.
Yes,
I really feel, and that's in the bigger political sense,
mm-hmm.
you know, in the world of politics, if people feel really heard,
yes,
they will be able to listen to each other and work better.
No,
there's lots of other things, but to me that's over it. And people, in terms of hearing each other, there is emotional and narrative content that's often overlooked. The ideas are only one piece of what's going on.
Right.
People's stories are incredibly potent and incredibly... You can't disagree with a story of somebody's telling of their life.
Right, right.
It's their story, you know, mm-hmm. regardless of what happened. This is what they think happened. That's their reality, and often, as was the case in the thing that happened in the Queen's Magazine thing, where the other people don't, people who are listening to you don't know about it.
It was
the Queen's Magazine is this Canadian Time magazine,
right?
And they hired their polling firm to find them people who represented the diversity of Canada.
Mm.
And between McLean's and their polling firm, they came up with these 12 people who were chosen for their differences. So these are people who are just, you know, the Quebec people and the Indigenous person and the people who want a strong central government. All these are all mixed in together.
Mm-hmm.
And McLean said, you've got 3 days to come to an agreement about a vision for Canada, and hired Roger Fisher, who's from Harvard, who is a co-author of Getting to Yes, which is a classic world-changing book on negotiation,
mm-hmm.
To come up and facilitate this. And by the end of Saturday, you know, the second day, it's a mess. You know, people are at each other's throats,
mm-hmm.
and Fisher doesn't quite know what to do. He's
mm-hmm.
off in the next room fiddling with chart pads, and it's the end of dinner, mm-hmm. and there's this woman from Quebec who is just beside herself with upset.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's just pouring out her emotion. A bunch of people are upset with her and have left. And there's several people sitting around, and this one other Canadian woman is just really listening to her and empathizing with the way she's feeling. And after an hour or so of this, the Canadian woman says, you know, if this is possible, anything's possible.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly she gets on board with getting this agreement rolling. And the next morning she listens to this Indigenous woman, Indian woman, and says, what's it like for you? You know, and the Indian woman pours out what's going on with the tribal groups. And after that purging of stories and emotion, suddenly everything starts to work much smoother.
Mm-hmm.
And all the work that Fisher was doing in the next room, you know, picking pieces of possible agreement off of the chart pad notes from the last 2 days,
mm-hmm.
he can pull that out of his pocket, and there's some people who are actually interested in reading it and doing something with it,
mm-hmm.
and they spend the rest of the day going through, you know, like 3-4 iterations of this before they come up with something, and then everybody signs it, there's this love fest, and they all go home.
Mm-hmm.
And this
mm-hmm.
is 40 pages of coverage, unbelievable, it's all on my website at PDF form, mm-hmm. so anybody can read the original articles and see the original.
It's very
original pictures.
It's very heartwarming. Very heartwarming story.
Amazing stuff.
Yeah.
And there's so few descriptions of these public dialogues and deliberations in enough detail to really see the dynamics.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what makes one of the things that makes it so remarkable
mm-hmm.
is there's really enough detail to see it. But the thing that's over and above that remarkable is that McLean's did so much coverage.
Yes.
They describe each one of the people who participated in enough detail that you, if you're like that person, you know that and you resonate.
Yeah.
You wonder what happened to them
mm-hmm.
if they went through the dialogue. And you can see what happened to them if they went through the dialogue.
So you kind of feel like your voice was heard as well if you're kind of like that.
Exactly.
Yeah,
there's this funny vicarious thing that happens, which is at the heart of a lot of art. You know, great books and great performances and movies and whatever, you identify with the characters,
mm-hmm.
and that's a good chunk of what goes on, and
mm-hmm.
a lot of personal and social and interpersonal relationships kinds of things can
mm-hmm.
get worked through, and you can learn something vicariously. And this is applying that same thing to the political process, but it requires the mass coverage, the mass media.
Mm-hmm.
They also had simultaneously Canadian Broadcasting did an hour-long documentary, which was broadcast the same week that McLean's released the report. So
wow.
It was a very powerful, powerful thing. But they didn't think of it as a democratic exercise. I couldn't believe it. I hired this guy to didn't find out what happened, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they just thought of it as a fancy kind of focus group.
Well, it's certainly not what democracy tends to look like or what we call democracy.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
But like Jim Ruff has raised the question of what if you were to do something like this every year as an official function of government?
Mm-hmm.
You know, pick a randomly selected group of people from the society
mm-hmm.
and have them do a State of the Union address.
Right.
You know, what do you guys think how we're going? What would happen if that happened in the United States?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you had randomly selected, you'd get some really wild variations.
I bet, yeah.
And you put them through something like dynamic facilitation where
mm-hmm.
they can really hear each other,
mm-hmm.
and then they come up with a statement that's broadcast to the entire society.
Yes.
And that's going to happen. Everybody knows that's going to happen every year.
Mm-hmm.
And so next year they're wondering who's going to be chosen. You know,
mm-hmm.
suddenly this big thing, and lots of attention being focused on it. The possibilities are quite exciting. And you could make it this. Such a group wouldn't have to have any traditional power.
Mm-hmm.
Its power would be, you know, the resonance that it created in the larger community, the common sense-ness that it came up with, et cetera. And the sense of possibility. I mean, all of our experience leads us to believe that all you can do is fight. The chances are you're not going to get what you want.
Mm-hmm.
That it's a compromised, stuck mess is what politics is.
Well, even when I talk to people about consensus decision making, usually the first thought that they give back is, "Oh, that means we're going to have to compromise. Consensus means we have to give in." But this is not what you're talking about.
No, and it's even worse because there's many people who supposedly use consensus process where the way you get your agreement is to silence voices.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of people who are part of the underprivileged parts of the society whose voices traditionally are not heard,
mm-hmm.
who don't want anything to do with consensus process because that's what comes out of it. That's the nature of the process.
Well,
and things like dynamic facilitation.
Mm-hmm.
are not like that at all. And there is the ability to search for common ground rather than shutting people up
mm-hmm.
has a whole different feel to it. And there are a number of processes that do that really well.
Mm-hmm. So what happens when I think of the examples of Native American circles when people would sit around and they would talk for days if needed, either passing around a talking stick, one person talking after the other, no one interrupting each other, and they wouldn't stop until everyone had said what they wanted to. And I've heard that they didn't really have to make any decisions after that. Kind of what was needed was obvious.
Yes, that's in the prologue of the book, I talk
mm-hmm.
about an experience I had in the cross-country Great Peace March in 1986.
Oh, I was hoping you'd talk about that. Could you please?
Yes. I'll tell that story. Yes, it's in a funny way, like the Canadian stuff. It's an archetypal kind of story. It was one of the watershed experiences of my life.
Mm-hmm.
The Great Peace March was originally envisioned to have 5,000 people marching across the country. This was in the peak of the Reagan administration
mm-hmm.
to
done to prevent nuclear war.
Yes.
And it attracted a wild variety of people. It didn't get its 5,000 people. It started with about 1,200 people from L.A., and 2 weeks out, the organization that started it was called ProPeace, and they went bankrupt. And we're out there in the middle of the desert, in the Mojave Desert, in our little tent city, and the guy that started it comes out in a helicopter and lands in our... He wasn't on the march. He lands on the campsite. Says, "Hey guys, it's all over. We're going bankrupt. Everybody should go home." You know, and like 800 people went home, and there were like 400 people who didn't want to go home, or maybe they divorced their spouses or sold their homes, or whatever. They thought they were going to be on this march. They had nowhere to go home to, and so there's a bunch of people there with no leadership, no resources, stuck in the middle of the desert. You know, it's like biblical kind of.
Yes, I was thinking the exact same thing.
And we're, and you know, all hell breaks loose. It's like these, and we don't know what. How do you make a decision? How do you make the decision about how you're going to make your decision from the ground up? And we hold up in this place in Barstow for 2 weeks. Lots of meetings, talking, people coming and going, and finally we got started. Once we were all vulnerable, churches and peace groups were coming forward to give us all sorts of supplies, and we stumbled our way across the country for 9 months with nobody in charge. And that's with 400 people, you know. Where do you put 400 people each day? You know, marching 15 miles a day about. It was like this gigantic logistical and community challenge, and it was what happened. It was this changed my life in so many ways. But in terms of what's possible, I had never been part of a group that got coherent without some kind of leadership scene.
Yes, right.
And one of the most, and there were actually several leadership centers, but there none of them ever got control of any of the others. So it was a zoo. Anyway, the specific incident that I write about was we were getting very divided over whether we should march all together to make a good impression for the media, and because of traffic and all the rest, or whether we should, you know, let anybody walk however they wanted, sort of strung out along the road, and you know, appreciate nature, talk to the farmers and the kids, whatever. And people felt really strongly about this. There were more than half of the marchers for whom this issue was a make-break issue, and they needed to be decided on their side. And people were saying, if this is going to be done the way you want it, I'm going home. And it felt like a real crisis. And we're in Colorado. I can't remember where exactly in Colorado. It was June, I think. And there was a big thunderstorm out of nowhere came. We were tented on a fertilizer factory lawn, setting up our tents, and the storm came, and just incredible downpour. And most of the marchers flee into the fertilizer factory, and we're crowded around this stinky place, all these stacks of chemicals all around us, and a tin roof, the rain beating on the roof, and somebody brings in a PA system, portable PA system, and we had learned talking sticks. Style communications. They said, "Hey, let's use the microphone as a talking stick. Anybody who wants to talk about this issue that's dividing us, take 2 minutes, say your piece, and hand the stick off to somebody else."
And nobody interrupts them, and nobody challenges them. Right?
There's no, you know, specific back and forthing. It's just each person speaks their passion. And it was incredibly passionate. You know, people were sobbing, people were screaming. It was just, and all most of us are just shuffling around, sweaty in this stinky place. And I noticed, I didn't end up saying anything the whole time, but I noticed that I would think of something I would want to say in response to what somebody said, and within a couple of speakers after that, somebody else would say it. And I sort of got, hey, I don't have to say anything here, you know. The issue is being digested by this larger collective body.
Yes.
And it began to feel like I was embedded in this thing I came to call the March Mind, which is like this big mind that's going, well, if I do it this way, it comes out like that. And I do it that way, it comes out like that. And I don't really like that, so I could twist it around this way. But that would, I don't really feel good about it. It's like back and forth, looking at this, looking at that. And it felt like it was bigger than us, that we were, it wasn't that there was a collective thing manifesting because of us. It was that we were manifestations of this collective thing. It sort of turned that inside out. I had a very palpable sense of that. And after a couple of hours of this, the rain stops and everybody goes out to the tent. And I realized that we know what we're going to do, that we're going to be marching together in the cities where that's where most of the media is, that's where the traffic problems are.
Mm-hmm.
People will be staring out their windows at us, the workers. And in the country, we'll be strung out because mostly it's, you know, there's not a lot of room along the side of the highway, and that's where the farmers are, and that's where the nature is. It's just sort of, it all sort of fit.
Mm.
And nobody had said, hey, is there a consensus here? Nobody said, let's vote on it. Nobody, it was none of that. It was just talk, until all the dimensions of the problem were visible to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, over the next weeks and months, that's what we did.
Mm-hmm.
And there was never a decision made. And
wow.
To me, that was revolutionary. I'd never been in a group where people acted together without ever making a decision.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And then I stumbled across this quote from Orrin Lyons, who's a native leader, a state keeper of the turtle clan of the Onondaga Iroquois. And he said, in our councils, we sit and talk until there's nothing left but the obvious truth.
Yes, yes.
And that phrase was perfectly descriptive of what I'd been through.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, okay, how can we do this more often in more places? How can we make that kind of intelligence, that kind of informed collective intelligence, you know, open to each other, open to larger realities?
Mm-hmm.
How do we put that at the center of our politics?
Mm-hmm.
The debate between sides doesn't come close to that. It can't.
No.
It's designed to shut things down, not open things up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's why if you talk about wholeness as being the center of my work, you know.
Yes, yes.
What is the whole picture? What are all the voices? What's all the information?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what are all the perspectives that should be involved? You know, that's the more we can include well, the more whole it becomes. So you never arrive at total wholeness, you know. Or you're always in all
different perspectives on it.
Right, you know,
right.
Both are true.
Mm-hmm.
But that search for including and integrating more pieces of reality, more forms of consciousness, more kinds of capacity is what this work's all about.
Well, you talk about social process activism versus social issue activism. There having been a time in your life where one switched into the other, and I'm wondering if I could take you up on your offer to work co-intelligently with me for a minute on stuff that we have happening in our community.
I'm happy to give it a try.
And we as I mentioned to you, we're starting to, you know, talk about peak oil and the whole issue of resource depletion, and it's not something that you'll hear Washington talking about very much, or the major media, because let's face it, it's not going to sell anybody any stocks or make anyone rich to talk about, you know, the kind of life that we've come to depend on starting to close down on us just from the natural cycles of, you know, taking half the oil out of the ground and the next half being more difficult to get out than the first half, and India and China coming on as major industrial powers, and us facing the very great likelihood of shortages and depletion and soaring prices. Goldman Sachs talked about predicted gold oil, which is like gold, at $105 a barrel by 2007. And, you know, oil geologists and now even oil industry insiders and the International Energy Agency are starting to admit, yeah, I guess we might have a problem here. We better start some austerity measures. And so what we're doing is we're just starting a process. We haven't even gotten together yet, but I'm starting to plan a process of getting people together. And I'm very much thinking about it in the way you describe. Your work is social process work, social process facilitation, which is to say it's not about me coming up with a solution or a proposal and hoping people will adopt it, but about creating a space in which, you know, we can all work together. So I'm wondering if you can just think with me a little bit, or just imagine with me, and tell me how you see something like this operating, how you would see a community coming together best to bring all of its constituencies together to learn about this and then to start talking about, you know, what we might do about it without, you know, any one person or one group of people having an agenda or trying to take it over. What would that look like? Or what could that look like?
Well, there's a lot of, if you think in terms of a good event at which people can talk.
Mm-hmm.
It's relatively simple, and there's some great options. The challenge, and I can talk about those if you want, there's things called open space.
I was thinking about that one in particular. Yeah.
Open Space, World Cafe, and Future Search are ones I picked right off the top as being appropriate to that circumstance.
Why don't you go ahead and describe each of those briefly, if you could, just for our listeners and for me, and we'll see if we can kind of plug one in and see how it might work.
Okay, well, I'll just quickly touch base on the other thing, which is an event is limited in what it can do, and ultimately what you want in order to deal with this issue is a way for the community to learn together over and over and over again.
Yes, absolutely.
So what it comes up with, it can then take that back into its, you know, collective thought and reflect and come up with, you know, learn from its experience and move on to something, you know, further on.
Yes.
That embedding the capacity to do this stuff, the capacity for collective reflection into the community,
yes,
is a greater challenge than doing an event.
Yes, I
quite, I want to stress that, because ultimately, if you're handling issues like this,
mm-hmm,
they're not, hey, here's the solution, now let's just do the solution.
Right.
They're issues that grow and morph in their complexity,
right,
and need to be addressed continually, so the capacity building is gigantic.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll give you those three processes. Open space is a one of the most powerful self-organizing things for a community or an organization. It's basically everybody who comes should be passionate about the topic. Doesn't matter what they think, which direction, you know, what their opinions are, if they're different, whatever. They just need to be passionate.
Mm.
And there is no, there's no topic. There is a topic, but there's no speakers. There's no workshops organized. It's just empty slate. Everybody sits in a circle, and the facilitator explains that they're going to create their own schedule, their own conference.
Mm-hmm.
You know, who wants to talk about what? Just come up here, it's a bunch of markers and paper in the middle of the room.
Mm-hmm.
You're right, I want to talk about, you know, what are we going to do with our kids when we run out of oil?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, put that up on a thing and take a little post-it note. There's a bunch of post-it notes there with places and times on them. Take a post-it note, stick it on your paper, stick the paper on the wall. Next person comes up, says, I want to talk about, you know, how to switch to biodiesel, you know, or something like that.
Right.
Okay, so you write it down, announce it to the group, go stick it on the wall, and after everybody's finished, here's your schedule up on the wall.
Yep.
And then everybody does it. And if you want a really powerful one, you do it for at least 3 days. Because as you do it, as you go through the process, new topics will come up that people are passionate about,
mm-hmm,
and it's a collective learning process. It's extremely powerful.
Mm-hmm.
A one day will get you somewhere, but if you want to do it, if you did something like this every month or every quarter for 3 days, that alone would give you a way to process what's going on for the
Indeed.
Community to self-organize itself.
Indeed.
How
do you document that? I mean, because there's so many simultaneous sessions going on. How does the community then digest that?
Well, first of all, you're dealing primarily with the people who are there,
mm-hmm,
and they are self-organizing. You want to spread out in the community, somebody's going to have to take responsibility to get it out. There are ways of doing open space. We have a whole pile of computers there, and somebody, they say, when you convene a session, you're responsible for basically convening it and either taking notes or finding somebody else to.
I see.
And
yeah,
then they come out and they type it up into the computer, and if it's a multi-day one, the last day they will have, you know, right before the last day, they'll take it out to, you know, a copy place and copy it off, and everybody gets a copy of all the notes
yeah,
as they walk out.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So there are ways to do that. And it's very flexible. There's many different, there's lots to say about it. And there's a manual called Open Space Technology, and you can buy the book and do it yourself. It's a
yep,
very do-it-yourself process, no special training needed.
Yep.
World Cafe, similarly, same kind of thing, except that it's sort of all together. And World Cafe is people sitting around at cafe-like tables, having, they all share an interest and hopefully a passion in the topic. And they consider some question together. It's like tables of like four people at each table. You can have as many, you know, thousands of people if you want. You have big enough space. And then the facilitator, you know, rings a bell or makes some sign, and one person stays at a table and everybody else goes to a different table. And they carry on the conversation either with an old question they started with or with a new question. And the question design is the main aspect of World Cafe. And incidentally, a book just came out by Juanita Brown,
okay,
who is the co-creator of World Cafe, mm-hmm, first book on World Cafe.
Okay.
And this is another way. At the end, after people have gone through a number of rounds of this, then you can have a collective harvesting. It's not a report out because the groups are all, you know, broken up all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like, for you individually, what really spoke to you? Mm-hmm. What did you learn? What questions came up? What has heart and meaning for you?
Mm-hmm.
And you harvest those at the end all together.
Mm-hmm.
You could also go back and do more rounds. All sorts of variations, again, you can do that. You can do, but it's again, a self-organized way of developing each other in all those little circles.
Mm-hmm.
And the future search, you need a professional facilitator for a future search.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a 3-day thing where the stakeholders, the stakeholder thing, so you get people who are majorly involved in the issue together, usually if some conflicted issue, and which this is, and people who have a stake in what's going to happen or need to be involved. And the first day they look at the history of the issue and their involvement in it. They make a timeline together on the wall, and anybody can put anything on the timeline. You can't stop somebody from putting something on the timeline. So you end up with this statement of what their life has been like together.
Mm-hmm.
Any differences that emerge are just set aside. They're acknowledged and set aside. They don't handle any conflicts in this process.
Mm-hmm.
The next day they look at what are the forces in the world that are shaping how we're going to respond to this and what we're going to be able to do and not do. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, what are the larger things going on right now? And that's clarified and created together.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third day is what kind of future do we want together?
Mm-hmm.
They create a collective vision, and then they break up into action groups to actually fulfill different aspects of that vision.
Mm-hmm.
That's another very powerful process, which tends to be used as a community process a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So those are three sample tools. The website, ncdd.org or thataway.org, the same thing. It's National Coalition for Dialogue and Deliberation,
mm-hmm.
and has extensive descriptions of these and, you know, a couple hundred other processes that could be used in these things,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and some guidance in which to use.
Mm-hmm. And we're getting down to the kind of the end of the hour here, and
I just want
to get a couple more things in here. First of all, since you're mentioning websites, can you tell people again where to find your material? I know your blog changed URL.
Yeah.
I want to make sure I got the latest one. So go ahead and let people know how to get a hold of you.
The blog is evolvingcollectiveintelligence.com.
Okay.
Evolvingcollectiveintelligence.com.
Okay.
And my website, the main website, is co-intelligence.org. And both of these, the particular website has hundreds of pages in it.
Mm-hmm.
Go on forever.
Mm-hmm.
And the NCDD site that I gave you is highly, highly, highly recommended. A lot of the things I wanted to do with my work, they're doing, so I'm supporting them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They're doing much better than I could.
And you get the Tao of Democracy also?
And Tao of Democracy is the book that I wrote, and it has its own website, taodemocracy.com. There's about 5 or 6 chapters mm-hmm. of the book that are online that you can read, including the story of what happened at the McLean's Experiment in Canada mm-hmm. is online. You can read it.
Highly recommend to all my listeners to check that out. It's just absolutely fascinating. You won't believe it, really. It's like what people can create when they come together in good faith, but having to also work through the conflicts. I mean, it wasn't a walk through the woods. They had to feel some uncomfortableness, but they made it through and came to the other side, and something emerged when they did. And I think that's the really fascinating part about this work. So I would like to ask you to leave us with some parting thoughts, and maybe I'll suggest you talk about many of our greatest 21st century challenges being unprecedented. We live in a time that has never been before. We never have had the kind of challenges we have now. And I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit in our last few minutes that we have about what is happening in our world today and how you see the approach of co-intelligence being the helpful in facing and moving through to solutions for these kinds of challenges that we have.
Well, we have the main things I see us doing are extending our power, that we are extending our power to global scale and beyond. We're extending our power down into atoms and DNA. We're extending our power into the oceans, the atmosphere. Some of this is by the advance of technology. Some of this is by the survival of more and more humans, so that anything, you know, billions of humans do has impact. And as more, you know, as all the Chinese and the
the Indians get their cars, et cetera, the impact of cars will go out the roof. Mm-hmm. We have a collective intelligence right now, a collective intelligence of science and technology, a collective intelligence of the market. These are skewed. These are not holistic. The market is run by the measure of money. All things must be measured by the dollar value. The gross domestic product is solely a measure of the money, amount of money that is spent in the society. The bottom lines of corporations are based on that. The idea that we can get what we need by understanding each other, understanding the needs of the natural systems that we live in, and working as partners with each other, working as partners with the natural systems, finding ways to monitor our immense creativity. We are like nature's creativity on speed, but we don't have a way to monitor what we do with that. Mm-hmm. And our ability to create things is increasing our ability to create things. Mm-hmm. So that now it's not even that difficult for somebody to create their own computer virus from things you can order on the internet.
Right.
And with the adequate equipment that is totally possible for a small group or an individual to own, et cetera. It's like those kinds of magnifications of human power need a gigantic influx of wisdom, systems thinking, and the kinds of things I'm talking about in terms of our reorganizing our politics is one piece of the answer. It's in no way the total answer, but it's one really important and not very well talked about piece to allow us to self-reflect on our own collectively, on our collective impact on each other in the world, mm-hmm. and tap into the deep wisdom that's buried in our own collective consciousness and our own ability to talk to each other in order to address those problems. And if we do, we'll have a different civilization. If we don't, we're beached fish.
Indeed. Well, I thank you so much, Tom Attlee, for joining us on our show. Tom is the author of The Tao of Democracy, Using Co-Intelligence to Create a World that Works for All. And I think your book really balances a realistic view of, let's wake up to what's going on with a very inspiring view that doesn't depend on experts or a few people in power to solve our problems, but basically says, we can do it together, and this is really what democracy is all about, and this is what our great experiment is leading us toward.
Yeah, this is like we're fighting each other on a sinking ship.
Yeah.
It's insane.
Yeah. So thanks so much.
Doesn't matter how right you are.
We could talk on and on, and I hope we'll be able to talk again, and I just thank you again for sharing your spirit, your generosity, and your vision with us.
Thank you. It's been fun.
All right. Thanks. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
All right, bye now. And you've been listening to Tom Attlee, the author of The Tao of Democracy, Using Co-Intelligence to Create a World that Works for All. And it's just a very, very inspiring work. You're also listening to WKNH 91.3 Keene.